Well, Jacques, thank you very much. That was very special from right there, and I'm sure around the whole building. Thank you so much. It's wonderful, as well as hearing Jacques sing, it's wonderful to be able to talk to you. Thank you for being with us to do that. I've known Jacques a long time, though I've known, well, my wife has known Jacques's wife a lot longer, I think about double, so that's about 20 years. But Jacques was part of our church family here when he was training to be an opera singer, married to Cara, who might be joining us later on. So she's
arrived.
Here.
Yeah, yeah.
Just arrived. Cara, thank you for being here. With two children, Amelia and Johnny. And I first of all want to ask you a bit about your story of how you ended up as an opera singer. And Jacques doesn't really like me saying this, but the story of how Jacques ended up here is not very Billy Budd, but is very Billy Elliot, if you know the story. So I just want to draw that. So just tell us, you grew up on not just a farm, but a sort of farm in the middle of nowhere in South Africa. Is that right?
Yes, in the middle of nowhere, but it's in the Free State, which is sort of the equivalent to the Midwest of America. So it's just farms, very sort of conservative Afrikaans. I'm a Boersie, and very much
and
in the sticks.
That means you're very South African, doesn't it? Is that, yeah?
Very Afrikaans, South African, yes. Yeah.
When did you learn to speak English?
My grandparents on the one side spoke more English, so we sort of heard English from a young age, but we learned to speak English from around about 7 in school.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And I guess hearing you sing now, people would assume that your parents were musical, there was music in the home, but that's not true, is it?
No, not at all. No, nobody did any music. Yeah, certainly not. No. I was the first.
No, no one was forcing you to do piano practice age 3, or
no. They I started piano a couple of times during school, but I just couldn't sit still in front of the piano. I wanted to be outside catching a rugby ball, so I had no interest, which I regret now. I wish I could play, but I never learned. No.
And you were in a school choir later on, but you told me you kept being kicked out. Why was that?
Yeah, I wasn't very popular with the choir mistress because I did wrestling as well. And so on weekends when the choir would have performances, I would be at the wrestling championships. So whenever they had a choir competition and they had to have a certain number of, or a limit on the number of singers in the choir, I would be one of the ones who was kicked out. Yeah.
And if at the time, if you'd been choosing wrestling or singing, you'd have chosen wrestling?
Yeah.
Easily. Okay, good. Yeah. So then, tell us how you were spotted or how the initial break happened.
Well, in South Africa, there's a boys' choir, a school called the Drakensberg Boys' Choir, and it's a similar setup in some ways to the Viennese Boys' Choir or the American Boys' Choir. It's not associated with the church or anything like that. It's a sort of concert performing choir. And anyway, they came to our little town in the Free State to do a concert, and everybody went, and the whole school went to go and see them. And we were 4 or 5 mates sitting in a row, and the conductor was a very scary English-speaking man, which for us Afrikaans...
That makes someone more scary, does it?
Yeah, well, it did back then, because we spoke very little English back then, he spoke with what we thought at the time was a very posh English accent, so he was scary enough. And he said there'll be auditions for boys between ages 10 and 13. And so we sort of, as a joke, said we're going to go have fun and do
something. The auditions were immediately after the performance.
Immediately.
It was come backstage now.
Come backstage, yeah. And so the four of us went, and he turned around and said, right, who's here for the audition? And the other three guys ran. and I wasn't brave for staying. I was too scared to run. I was frozen. And so he basically said, played a note on the piano, said, sing that, and played another note, said, sing that. And I did, and then said, how are your marks at school? And they were all right. And he said, yeah, you're in.
So it was how long? 1 minute?
Oh, yeah, just about, yeah.
That was the big break. That was it.
Yeah.
So that was a place at this special school somewhere a long way away. And you got permission from your father to go. Just say how you got permission.
Yeah. Well, my dad was asleep at home. He didn't come to the concert, so we went back home, and I sort of went into his room and shook him up and said, "I got into the school. This is how much it cost. Can I go?" And he sort of passed a half asleep, said yes, and I held him to it. So the next weekend we went to the school, to go have a look at it, and we arrive, and it's in the middle of the Drakensberg. So the school is on this little bank, and it's surrounded by the majestic Drakensberg mountain range. And 200 meters below the school, there's a river running, and there was a rugby field there, and the boys were kicking a rugby ball and riding horses, and there were a couple of zebras running around. So I just thought that's a great place to go.
So again, it's not really the music that is
No, not at all.
Good. Yeah. Then you were at the school for 4 or 5 years. You end up with singing as a hobby. You're good at it, but it's not the end of everything. You are getting singing lessons, but you choose your degree so you can carry on with singing lessons. But the degree is not music.
No, I wanted to study medicine, but while I was at school, I started taking singing lessons as a result of a sort of an iced effort with a singing teacher, who was a teacher at this university, and he was very good. And this university didn't have medicine, and so I thought law was the next best thing.
You studied law. Were you a good student of law?
Oh, I was terrible. My marks were right, but I was not interested in it at all. I skipped as many classes as I could. I was a terrible law student.
And so halfway through law, you transfer to music.
Yeah.
And at that point, you are now hoping that music might be a career for you. Is that right? That sort of potential?
No, not really. No, I... I had a terrible exam, a law exam, which sort of made me make the choice to do music. I was singing this in a university choir. And
when you say made you make the choice, did they make that choice for you?
I was supposed to do this. I went on a little tour with the Six Voice a cappella group at the end of the year, which was supposed to be when we do the exams. And I got permission to do a special exam when I come back in January. And normally the exams are 50% multiple choice questions and then essays the rest. And so I prepared all the multiple questions of the previous 5 years, and so could have passed on that alone and then studied 4 out of the rest of the 5 chapters. My mates were having a big party the night before the exam, and so I eventually gave up and didn't study the 5th chapter and went into the exam hall, opened the paper, and there were no multiple choice questions. It was all all essays, and most of it came out of the 5th chapter, so I just immediately closed the paper and said thank you. I didn't even write my name, and I walked out and got on the phone to my mom and said, my heart's just not in it. I think I'm going to go study music.
Yeah.
And she said, fine. Good. My parents have always been great. She just said, fine, that's fine.
Good decision.
Yeah.
So you finished that degree, but then at 23, you land a scholarship to the Royal College of Music here in London. You were there for 3 years, 2 postgraduate diplomas there. And now, is that decision point? Now you want to try and be an opera singer?
Not yet.
Have you made up your mind yet? Are you now?
No, not always. Okay. Now I can't go back. That's the thing. We had a friend who lived in the same small town as we did on the south coast of the Western Cape. Eventually, my parents moved down there, and we had a barbecue one holiday when he was back. He was studying at the Royal College, and he said you should go and audition, and so I did, and I got the place. And thought, well, I should go. And then I went, and one thing leads to another, and you get to the next stage, and you think, well, I'm doing it. I should probably do this. And then it wasn't until I got onto the Young Artist Program at the Royal Opera House that I sort of thought, well, you've come this far. There's no going back, really. You're doing this now.
Okay. We're going to come back a bit to your time at college in a second. So just to fill in the gap forwards, you won a competition. I think we have a picture of you winning the competition. Can we have this is the Cardiff Singer of the Year. Is it coming up? No, here we go. There we go. So that was in 2007.
Yeah.
So unchanged. There we go. where is Cara? You told me that Cara was rooting for the other guy. Is that right?
There was an audience prize, which is the one that the audience votes for. Sort of people at home watch it on TV. And Cara was convinced the Chinese guy was going to get it, he won the overall. He won the judges' vote, so did win the competition. But she was sitting next to me, and I hadn't gotten through to the final. So the final is
judges. Yeah,
they pick one from every night, and I didn't get through on my night. So there was no chance I was going to get the audience prize, basically. And when they said, okay, and the audience prize winner is Macaris, it's going to be the Chinese guy. And then they said my name, and the shock on her face was great. She was like, well, what? But yeah.
Sure. But that got you noticed. Then, yeah. As you say, you got a young arts program at the Royal Opera House, which is sort of training, you're singing there, you're learning roles. And then Glyndebourne had you sing Billy Budd. So, yeah. So what we just heard, actually, that's your breakout role. Yeah. That's your signature role, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And now you're world famous. I announced Jacques on Monday night at the church near here, and a man in the rows kind of at the idea that we had Jacques here. So that's great. Just so your non-musical parents, what do they think of you, of what you do for a living now?
I mean, they've always been great, and they love it. They don't understand it at all. And I mean, my dad always thinks I'm much better than I am. So he can't understand why I'm not singing there and there and there. He basically thinks I should be Bryn Terfel, and he doesn't quite understand why I'm not. And my mum just says, it's great all the time. So it's
And Billy Budd, you've just finished at the Royal Opera House with so that the Independent said you are the definitive Billy. He's sung this part so often he virtually owns it. Someone very kindly gave us tickets, so I went with my son. Can we see the picture? Who has been growing his hair for 6 months so that he can look like Jacques. So there we go. Hey. That's the dressing room. Let's have the next picture as well. So this is Jacques on stage. The wrestling came in handy, shall we say, because you are basically on stage with your shirt off the whole time. Is that right? A lot of the script is about how beautiful you are. Is that right? That's the...
Yeah, but it's more internal goodness and strength and things. And he's supposed to be good looking, but you have to use their imaginations.
Good. Okay. Thank you. Good. So there is the Billy Elliot story, if you like. But you're also a Christian. And that's why we've asked you here tonight to talk a bit about that. So we better get on with that part of the story as well. Just help us understand what it's like to grow up as a Christian in the sort of South African, Afrikaans, Dutch Reformed world. What kind of world did you grow up in?
So it's probably changed a lot now in the last 20 years. But when I grew up, everybody went to church. Certainly in the Afrikaans community, I don't think I knew one of my friends at primary school who didn't go to church on a Sunday. We all went to school on a Sunday, all went to Sunday school. It was just part of how you grew up. And some of the teaching at some of the churches was solid and very good, and some of it was less good. Some of the Bible teaching was less clear. And the danger of everybody going to church was, of course, nominal Christianity. So everybody grew up believing that they are Christians. It was sort of almost a cultural rite or a birthright. We grew up in church, so we're all Christians.
Do you remember age 14, sort of thinking, "Yes, I'm definitely a Christian now"?
Yeah, I sort of believed it the first time I heard it as a very small child, 5-6 years old. It was said Jesus died on the cross for us. And so we're saved. And I, in a very basic way, I believed it, and I never stopped believing it. But when I was 14, this boys' choir school, we did a concert in a very charismatic church in Pretoria, the Rhema Church. And they had the thing where they, at some point in the service, say, anybody who wants to give their life to Jesus and who wants us to pray for them, you raise your hand, stand up, and then at the end, everybody came forward. And
I probably say we're not planning to do that tonight, if you're nervous about that. But.
I was sort of overcome as a 14-year-old child, and I stood up and I went. And then they gave you a little booklet and a short talk with you and things. And then that evening, I got into the host parents' car, and they were a Christian family. The boy was in school with me. And sort of as we... or later that night when we were at their house, the dad came to me and said that, I hear it was a big special time in your life tonight, a big day in your life. And I sort of said yes, but I didn't feel it, just because I knew that I'd believed this for a long time already. It wasn't that was the day that I gave my life to Christ. I believed it for a long time.
What did being a Christian and from that background mean for you? How religious were you? Let's ask.
It ebbed and flowed. I mean, as I grew up in the various stages, the more I knew, yeah, you know, things changed. Certainly in high school, when I reached high school, I was vice leader of the CU at school, and I led a little Bible study at school. I went to an outreach. A congress and things like that, and at my first year, a couple of years at university, I would do the holiday mission thing. So I was
so quite religious. You're leading Bible studies, preaching, doing outreaches. Okay, then you come to London, and you were invited here quite early on. You came to church here in your first few weeks. Is that right?
Yeah, I went to see you. I should probably qualify. I certainly wasn't. Great, always great. Before I came here, I went through patches as well. So, I wasn't always. Yeah, anyway. But when I did arrive, the first couple of weeks, I went to see you, and we used to call them the lovely two Jennies, Jenny Quinn and Jenny Lancaster back then. And they said, "Come to see you," and they come to church, and they brought me here, and that's how I ended up at St. Helens.
They used to come, both play the cello, didn't they?
Yes.
So both used to bring cellos and leave, and there was probably £200,000 worth of cello left by the door. Every Sunday night. But at the college, you were coming under the influence of a different group of friends. Just say what happened and why.
Yeah. Singers are always loud at college. We're always the annoying group who thinks they're great and who think they... and a lot of them are, sort of act cool. And I've never been cool in my life, and my wife will attest to that. I've got very bad taste, and I'm socially completely inept. But
and you're shy, which is not what people will have thought from the singing edit.
Exactly. I'm quite reserved, and as you can hear, I'm not great at speaking. But I got in with the singers, the crowd very quickly because I could sing reasonably well.
And you were saying, so they were sort of ignoring you, shunning you, not quite shunning, but then there was audition, is that right?
Well, no, it was sort of the cooler guys at College Hall sort of, you know, didn't sort of steer clear of me for a while. And then after about the third week, we had a mass choir rehearsal. We were the whole of college basically perform a work with orchestra. And I was sitting near these guys, and... when we started singing, they sort of, and immediately afterwards came and said, "Oh, yeah," because they heard
me
sing.
Because you could sing.
Because
you
could sing, all of a sudden, yeah. I was right.
And you were cool for the first time in your life. Yeah. Is that right?
Probably, sort of.
And that must have been a big deal, and you were then good friends with them. And what did they make of your Christian faith?
Well, I mean, a lot of them sort of came through Eton and were choral scholars at Cambridge and things, so they all came from some sort of religious background and stuff, but I don't think they always got great teaching necessarily, but they respected it in some ways, but they also joked about it. I would be on a Wednesday when we had RML here, I would sort of leave the pub earlier after we used to go to the pub near college, and then I'd go and say, you know, see you later, and they'd say, are you off to go do God again? So they weren't mean about it, but they certainly they took the odd dig. But I mean, I don't want to make them sound like bad. They were lovely. Some of them were really good friends, and some of them are still good friends. It's just they weren't. They didn't.
And their lifestyle wasn't, let's say, Dutch Reformed, conservative Christian.
No. They didn't want God for me. That's what they weren't interested in my relationship with God. They were interested in my relationship with them and with singing and all that.
And you're following them, you're drinking with them, you're in a relationship soon after.
It was sort of near the end of my time at college, certainly my final year at college. I'd been single for a few, or hadn't had a girlfriend since I'd left South Africa. And I'd been spending a lot of time with these guys, and the influence and the way they lived seemed very appealing at some stages, and eventually... there was a girl who was interested in me, and we sort of got into a relationship. Yes, I knew she wasn't Christian, which would complicate things for obvious reasons. But I still went into the relationship.
And we're not going to go into details, partly because she's not here to give her side of the story, partly because it's not really any of our business. But over the course of a year, year and a half, you came to the point where you felt Jesus wouldn't really want anything to do with you anymore.
Yeah, I'd gradually, sort of before the start of the relationship, and then I certainly I was still coming to St. Helens quite regularly, and even to Bible study, midweek Bible studies, but outside of St. Helens, I was certainly not always living the way I should be living as a Christian. And when I got involved with her, and because of how our relationship went very quickly, I then sort of started not coming to St. Helens anymore. Having come from partly from a conservative background, and also because of what I knew to be true from the Bible and things, I felt very guilty about how I was living at that time, and that guilt made me not want to. It made me feel like I shouldn't be amongst the people of St. Helens and come here.
Mm. And just say a bit more about how. Well, maybe what did you think Jesus thought about you at that point?
Well, I'm so self-involved that I probably didn't think enough of what he thought about me, because I knew the truths of the Bible, I knew how we stand before Christ, but I was so obsessed with where I was and how guilty I felt about my own sin that I almost didn't think what he thought, but I certainly felt that I wasn't good enough to spend time with him. And I knew that wasn't true, but just the guilt sort of blinded me from the truth that that's not the case. I just felt that I'd grown up being a Christian, believing all these things, having been given all this good teaching. I've received so much as a Christian, had all the sort of background of somebody who should be a mature Christian and should be living a life serving Christ. And I just went around with it very, very cheaply.
Again, I guess some people would enjoy that. You weren't enjoying being away from church things. You were feeling...
No, I was miserable. I mean, I felt terrible. At the same time as moving away from church, I slightly started moving away from some of the friends as well. So it was sort of a double-edged sword. But no, I felt miserable.
The Christian friends?
No. Well, non-Christian friends as well. I sort of... And then... until it sort of reached, Simpo was on the phone to me one day. I was bawling my eyes out to him, just sort of saying, this has happened, and I've been here, and I've done this, and this is how I feel. And still after that, it took me months before somebody made me come to my senses and come back.
Yeah. And you said to me earlier, you thought Jesus would sort of turn you away. It was, you'd taken the advantages and... throwing them in his face.
Exactly. I just thought I had all the gifts, and it was just I threw them back, and so why on earth would he want me back? I just felt I shouldn't be there.
And then one of the Jennies, it was a Jenny again, wasn't it? One of the Jennies said, come back to church, and you said, no, I don't deserve to go anymore. And what did she say?
We were in the canteen at college. And I was sitting with other people, and she came up and said, we haven't seen you at church for a while. Why didn't you come out? And I basically said, well, I don't think I deserve to be there. And she brilliantly said, that's just stupid. That's exactly why you should come to church. And so I did the following Sunday. And I sat through the service, still feeling very guilty, and then went to After Eight.
Which is some food afterwards.
Food and drink. And one of the first people I walked into was William Taylor, who's the rector here. And he asked me the same question. We haven't seen you around for a while. Why is that? And I don't know why I said it, but I just said exactly the same thing. I said, I don't think I deserve to be here. I've been really rubbish. And he just said, go and read Luke 15.
Not everyone will know. What's in Luke 15? Why?
So I went home and opened the Bible, and it's the parable that Jesus tells about the prodigal son. There's a father. He's got two sons. He's a wealthy man. He's got lots of livestock and things. And one of his sons comes up to him and says, "Please, can I have my inheritance now?" And his father agrees to it, gives it to him, and the young man goes off and goes and lives very recklessly with his inheritance. Famine comes over the land, and he's got nothing left. He ends up without anything, ends up getting a job feeding another man's pigs, and he is in such bad shape that he's hungry and longing for the food that is being fed to the pigs, but nobody would even give him that. And then he thinks to himself, well, the servants at my father's house, they are treated better than I am. I'll go back to him and say, treat me as a servant. He then goes back to his father, who just welcomes him and throws a big festival, a big party for him, gives him a fancy robe, slaughters the most the biggest calf. So he just takes him back as if he's the most wonderful son.
And it's probably obvious, but why did that resonate with you particularly?
Because he was, he knew the son had recognized how rubbish he was and how he didn't deserve it at all. And that's where I was on that day, yeah.
Yeah. And you'd have known all that intellectually. You'd have been explaining it to other people when you were 18.
Yeah.
How would you now explain it to someone feeling the same as you? What would you say to someone feeling that I've blown it, I've hit my last chance with Jesus and there's no hope?
That's why Jesus died on the cross. If we could deserve it, if we had any value to bring to the relationship with God, then Jesus there was no need for him to die on the cross. So that's exactly how we need to come to Christ, is knowing that we bring nothing, we have no value towards our own salvation, and that's why we need a Jesus to die on the cross for us.
Thank you. Since then, let's do some of the story since then. So, you've been a perfect Christian since then?
Gosh, no. My wife will tell you no. No, and my children as well. No, of course not. We still struggle with sin, and I certainly struggle with a lot of sin. But you
no longer feel guilty in the way that you did?
No. The guilt is... it should have been before. I should have known that before. But I know that is why Christ died for us. We are sinful human beings. We're called to live differently once we are saved. But we are still unable to do it perfectly. If we were able to, then we wouldn't have needed Jesus to die on the cross.
And that tension is something we're going to talk a bit more about later on tonight. Yeah. But you talk about not wanting to live cheaply on grace. Just say what you mean by that.
Jesus gave everything on the cross for us. He paid for our sins completely. And for all the horrible things I did, all the horrible things that will still be done, he's carried the punishment for that. And for me then, to having received that amazing grace, to then go and live in a way which doesn't show thankfulness for that, also doesn't obey the command that we are to try and live as people who are changed and live by the Spirit and not by the flesh. In other words, live by the Holy Spirit, what God has done for us, rather than our desires as human beings. That's just wrong.
A lot of people would think that doesn't make sense. Yeah. That actually being told you could be forgiven for free repeatedly would make you live, in a terrible way.
Yeah, well, I think firstly we're told not to. The Bible says we should live differently. We should live as people who are saved, so that we should be obedient to God in that sense. So try to live lives can't be worthy, but trying to be more Christ-like. And then secondly, how can you not live differently out of thanks for being saved, being so wretched, being so of no value? And still he saw so much value in you that he gave everything and died for you. How can you not live differently after that? And we still do. A lot of the time we don't live differently, but we have to try.
Thank you. And then I just want to ask you a few questions as we close about what it's like being a Christian in the world, the career, the job you're in. And in particular, you had quite a difficult period recently, didn't you, when you had a health problem which sounds horrendous, something, say the blood vessels in your neck or something?
Well, no, on my vocal cords. Okay. I had to do, it was the same production we just did at the Opera House, but we did it in Rome, and there's a moment where Billy sort of pulled off where he's bound and he's pulled back out of the trial scene, and he sort of pulls against it and shouts, which isn't in the music, but we put it in, and I was having lots of back pain and taking strong anti-inflammatories, which thins the blood vessels, and I screamed and I burst blood vessel on my vocal
blood
cord.
Blood came out? You've just done that and just...
No, I mean, it wasn't that graphic, okay. but I immediately felt something, and about 10 minutes after that, I have to sing the big final section, which comes before this, and when I opened my mouth, nothing came out. I burst the blood vessel and
that's a big deal. As in you're a, like a footballer or something. This is, you need this to work.
Yeah. I mean, it can be.
And you were just say you, the treatment was. Weren't allowed to speak for how long?
6 weeks. But I was allowed to speak very quietly to my kids, but I wasn't.
You were four and one at the
four
time.
Four and one, yeah. And my parents were visiting, and my father-in-law, and I couldn't get my father-in-law and my dad to understand that I can't speak. They kept on asking me questions, and I was trying to say, "Well, please, just leave me alone." So I turned into this very grumpy monster of a man. Poor Cara had to put up with so much during that time.
And again, how, as a Christian, you're facing potentially very serious bar to your future career if you don't get better. How do you cope with that as a Christian?
Well, I didn't very well, but I was very blessed that the people around me dealt with it very well. Cara was brilliant at praying a lot and making me pray. And we're our church in Market Harbour, the church family there prayed a lot. You know, Cara would every now and then say, "Let's just pray about it." And I almost got annoyed every time she said that, because I was feeling very sorry for myself. But God was very gracious, and he got us through it. And my voice is fine now, but more importantly, we're fine, and we're trusting in Jesus, and that's more important.
And we've interviewed here once before, I think 10 years ago or so, quite a long time. And then you said, singing is only a job. I could give it up. Like that.
Yeah.
Just again, now having had a moment when you were not even sure you would be able to sing again for the 6 weeks, you can't speak. What would you say now?
It probably won't be as easy as I thought it would be. If I'm honest, but it's not just the fact that I do enjoy singing. I do enjoy parts of my job a lot. But it was the fact that it's how I pay the bills and how I provide with Cara for my family, and that was the scary part. The fact that I So in terms of just giving it up, it's not as simple as I was very bravely saying 10 years ago. It's more complicated, but I certainly, if it's for the sake of my faith in Jesus, I hope I would be able to do it.
Yeah. And you're, again, a lot of people would, for the chance of being a famous opera singer, would think that comes first before everything. What would you say?
No, I'm a Christian first, then a husband, then a father. Then lots of other things, and then a singer. My identity is not Jacques the singer. I hope it's not, and I don't want it to be. And it's sometimes difficult not to feel like that in some ways. But my prayer for myself is that that my identity will always be Jacques the Christian, who believes in Jesus Christ and what he did for us, and that'll define who I am, and that'll define my life choices in terms of my job and my family and everything.
Yeah, Jacques. Thank you very, very much. We're very grateful to have had you with us. And what I'd like to do now is dwell on a couple of things that Jacques said, both of which are illustrated through his story. So, and I wonder if you were able to hold them together while he was speaking. So one is the sort of main topic of what we pushed him on, which is the feeling that he had let Jesus down, had disappointed him too often, but then found that actually he hadn't, found the wide open arms of the father and the prodigal son, no matter how he disappointed Jesus. That's one element. And then the other is what Jacques was saying towards the end about treating grace cheaply, that he'd been given much, and so he needed to obey Jesus, follow him, live for him. and that that was the right thing to do. And I wonder whether you were able to bring those two things together in your head while he was speaking, because I think those two elements, those two discoveries of Jacques, they run flatly against sort of natural default religion in all of us, the religion that we would generate for ourselves left on our own. So let me try and describe natural default religion and see whether you agree with me as I say it and see if you can see how it's different to what Jacques said. So in our natural default religion, I think there are two key features. I think first, we expect to be made to try by God. We expect to be made to try, but not too hard. I think that's the feature. So that we expect there to be religious duties or practices, things we have to do, but we expect it to be achievable. Nothing too extreme in what God would ask of us. Certainly not like give up being an opera singer. Nothing too extreme. And then second feature, we expect God to help us, but again, not too much. Because we want any eventual outcome, any improvement in us, to be our achievement. Maybe God helps, maybe God gives us a leg up at the beginning, but I'm not a total spiritual bankrupt. I'm someone that God has helped. But then I did the rest. I think that's, so my summary of natural default religion would be achievable achievement. I can do it with a bit of effort, and I have done it. It's me that did it. And that, I think, probably Jacques would say, that's what was behind the kind of total devastation of realizing I thought I could do it, I thought I was good enough, I thought I'd done okay, and then realizing, no, I'm not. I think both elements are perfectly illustrated by people who love chocolate during Lent. I think Lent, the sort of 40 days of Lent, gets it perfectly. It's a real cost. It's very hard to do. Go without chocolate for 40 days. Maybe God helps me when I'm tempted. God must surely notice and say, well done me for doing that. And anyway, it's kind of socially acceptable. It's temporary. It's nothing too extreme. But natural default religion is not what Jacques discovered and has come to live by. The real Jesus, as opposed to an imaginary Jesus, is both more generous and more demanding than most of us will ever allow ourselves to contemplate. And I just want to explore that a bit this evening. And it may be that as we do that, you may find yourself more hostile to Jesus than you were when you came in. Because the real Jesus and what he teaches, it is the end of human achievement. The end of being able to say, well done me, I've done all of it. And it's also not achievable without real personal cost. Following Jesus. So I'd like, if you would, please turn to page 23 in these booklets. Page 23, which is the turning point of this short account of Jesus' life, from Mark writing up Peter's memory, Peter, one of Jesus' closest friends, Peter's memory of being with Jesus and what he said and did. And verse number 27 there on page 23, we are at the halfway mark, the turning point of this book, and it's a great place actually to recap what we've been saying all week. So first notice that paragraph where it says Peter confesses Jesus as the Christ. This sort of recaps some of Sunday's material. In this book, if you were to take it away and read it, you would find huge frustration, I think, with the stupid disciples by this point, who just can't seem to get their head around who Jesus is. And then in verse 29, Jesus asked them, but who do you say that I am? Be a good question to ask yourself. Who do you say that Jesus is? And Peter answered him, you are the Christ. And if you were reading this from the beginning, you'd think, at last, they've got it, finally. They've understood the person who can calm storms and raise the dead and heal anything, he's someone special. He is God's king. And we're not going to go back over all that material from Sunday, but if Peter is right, one of the people who knew Jesus best, if he's right, then here's an obvious implication. If Jesus is God's king, then that means that what he says goes, which in terms of what Jacques has told us about tonight, means that if Jesus says you are forgiven, then you are. And actually, you know, if Jesus says you could be forgiven for anything and he's the king, it doesn't actually matter how bad you feel or how much you think you've let Jesus down, his word goes. He says you're forgiven, you are. But also it means if he says this is the best way to live, well, then he's right. Jacques talked about obedience to Jesus, and I don't think that was just the sort of conservative South African background coming through there. That goes with Jesus being king. If he's the king, then he knows the best way to live, and we should. Okay, that's the first thing. Second thing, just look down at the next paragraph, verses 31 to 33, and this recaps what we said last night. So what has Jesus come to do? What is his mission? And verse 31 is the first time he tells them about his death on the cross. Jesus began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. And it is a total shock to Peter. You'll see in verse 32, he starts rebuking Jesus, and Peter gets called Satan in verse 33. In other words, Peter's view of Jesus' mission, that to Jesus is a temptation to resist. Peter wants Jesus to be a king and be on a throne and look impressive, and Jesus treats that as a temptation straight from Satan, because Jesus has come to die. And that's where we see that Jesus is far, far more generous than natural default religion. Jesus is not here to help a bit. Jesus is here to help totally, to do everything for us to restore our relationship with God. And in the piece that Jacques sung, the sort of overtones of Jesus on the cross and a sense that this sailor goes willingly to his death to help out his shipmates and the captain in particular. But again, that doesn't get close to what Jesus did on the cross. We said last night that at its simplest, the death of Jesus is a swap. So if you think of maybe your list, or let's take Jacques as the example since he shared with us, the sort of list of things that you think you've done to let God down, the things you've done that you think God would not be happy with in the way you've lived your life, if there is a God, that you would have on your list against you. And it's as if Jesus goes right through that list, point by point, saying, that's mine. Saying to his father, treat me as if I did that. I want you to cross out Jacques' name or Charlie's name and write Jesus there instead. I did that, I did that, I did that. Please give me the punishment for what Charlie did. It's a swap. Very simple idea, it's a swap with an implication that there is no place for our achievement at all. We are total spiritual bankrupts, but also it means that anyone can be forgiven if it's a swap, and if it's a swap where he'll cross out where it says Jacques or Charlie or whoever else, then it means it will work for anybody. Cross out any name, any list, however long, and write Jesus' name on there instead. It's a swap. First two things. Here's the third thing. And this is where we move to new material tonight in terms of what is it that Jesus wants from us? And that's the final paragraph there on that page. What does Jesus want from us? And here is where, again, it's a shock to our natural default religion, because Jesus is very, very demanding. He's just said he's come to die, and now immediately he asks his followers to die as well. Let me read from verse 34 and 35. And he called to him the crowd with his disciples and said to them, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me.
For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. It's fairly explicit, isn't it, what he's saying? He wants us to deny ourselves, in other words, give up a life that is you lived for yourself, and follow him instead, obey him instead. And follow him, did you notice, up to and including the point where that costs us our lives? Again, do you hear how different that is from our normal default religion that says, I'll try a bit, but nothing too extreme, nothing too big? And over this week, we've talked to three different individuals. We've talked to Tracy and to Tim and to Jacques. And just in bits of their story, we've covered an incredible range of things that following Jesus has cost them or might cost them. We've talked about sex, we've talked about reputation, we've talked about career, talked about sort of artistic gift and performance. We could add to that from the verses we've got here, a couple more examples in verse 36. It is financial. Here is someone who might gain the whole world. And then in verse 38, just over the page, it is shame. For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation. Do you see what Jesus is ruling out at this turning point in the book with his disciples? He's ruling out somebody who says, Jesus, I'll follow you, but of course I'll go on sleeping with the person that I'm in love with. Or, of course, I'll not be expected to give up on getting as much as I possibly can out of this world for myself financially. I'll follow you, but of course, I won't be expected to own up to agreeing with everything that you said. Some of it would really be quite embarrassing, shameful. More demanding? You may even say just simply not achievable. Certainly not without significant cost. And the obvious question is, why would anybody bother? Why would someone like Jacques bother following Jesus like this? And I think that's where the three ideas we've had tonight all relate. If Jesus is God's king, well, then I should bother because he is allowed to tell me what to do and he should know best what is good for me. But if Jesus is the one who died for me, well, then he is the one that loves me the most. There is no one else who has ever done for me what the Lord Jesus Christ did. So trust him that what he asks us to do is good. But the main reason here is that you should do this because there is no other way to have life. There is no other way to live. Let me read verse 35 again. And just hear how all-encompassing it is. Verse 35, whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. Straightforward choice. In fact, there's a choice of where you would like to have your life. You could have your life now. In other words, you could live flat out for yourself now and get as much of the great, wonderful things out of this life as you can and ignore Jesus and not have the inconvenience, Tim called it last night, of trying to follow Jesus. But Jesus says if you do that, you will lose your life eternally. Or you could choose to give him your life and do the things he tells you to or try to. And that, Jesus says, is the only way to have life that lasts wonderfully beyond the grave with him. It's an important question, isn't it? I guess maybe an obvious question. What would you do to save your life? Is there anything you wouldn't do to save your life? And it sounds like an easy question, of course. Trade anything, swap anything to save your life. But just occasionally, people do get faced with that, just in normal daily life. I've begun collecting stories of people who've had to do this. I remember vividly the first one I ever read in a magazine where in 1993. Since then, there was the film, 127 Hours, but I've stuck faithfully to the 1993 version that I heard. So let me just tell you that. In October 1993, there was a man called Bill Jaracki, who's American, and he goes fishing. Goes fishing on his own. He drives up into the mountains, and he walks down a little slope towards the river to fish. And as he's walking, he slips, and he knocks a rock. And he says a rock the size of a fridge, a refrigerator, landed on his leg. And he's American, so I assume that's a big rock, big refrigerator. and he's lying there with the rock on his leg, and waits to be rescued. He's expecting someone else will come walking past, and he's there for several hours, and he realizes as the day goes on that there aren't any other people coming fishing that day. And he is in the mountains on his own, and that in October it's going to be cold that night, and he's going to die if he stays there. And at that point, you see why the age I was then, why I enjoyed the story, he starts going through his pockets, and in his pocket is a penknife. There's a lot of detail in the story that I will spare you tonight. But he sits there with his penknife open, and his choice is save leg, lose life, or lose leg, save life. And you'd think it would be a very straightforward choice, wouldn't you? But turns out, actually, he was quite attached to his leg. And he sits there weighing it up, and there's a brilliant description of the sort of sense of release he gets as he goes through the final bit of sinew. And he goes back into town, and he's fine, and he lives. I tell you that story partly just to underline how straightforward Jesus is with us here. There is no small print whatsoever with Jesus Christ. He offers you everything that you need. And the heart problem we talked about two nights ago, he will go to his death for you in your place, and you will be completely free. But he then calls you to follow him. And to do that, you must decide to give up all of what is killing you and is opposed to him so that you can follow him. And part of my job tonight is to stop you from becoming a Christian too easily, too cheaply, to use Jacques' language. The demand is extremely high. I need to say that Christians fail at this. Christians fail every single day to live up to Jesus' high standards. You will too if you were to start living this way. But there is no holding back at the start. There's no negotiation each time you realize that Jesus wants you to do something you don't want to do. There's no kind of, Jesus, that's a bit too much. No. Every time there is a wholehearted decision to give Jesus everything, and then every time we fail, there is what Jacques discovered, the wonderful forgiveness, the big wide open arms, and welcome back every time. And it makes total obvious sense to give up what is killing us, living for ourselves, in order to have life from Jesus. But I hope you can see it is the total opposite of what we tend to assume religion and Christianity is all about. In a sense, we're finished. I've got one more thing I want to do, but the encouragement I would leave you with there is to go home and investigate Jesus seriously. He is not who you thought he was. We've heard from three people this week who imagined Jesus to be completely other to how he really is. If you have not, as an adult, read through the words of Jesus, it would take you an hour or two, and thought seriously about him and what he's offering you, then I suggest you should do that. But I do want to finish just by saying what you would need to do if you're willing to take Jesus seriously and decide to follow him. I said last night, it's a prayer that's as simple as ABC, as in A, to admit that you need help and that you deserve God's anger for how you've lived. B, for believe, to believe that Jesus' death for me worked and that it is my only hope. And then C, what we've just been talking about, C, for commit, that I commit to give Jesus my whole life from now on. And I'm going to pray a prayer like that now, and it might be that one or two in the room are ready to pray along with me as I pray. We're not going to do what Jacques talked about. No one's going to put their hand up or stand up or anything. I'm going to pray out loud, and if you want to join in, you can pray quietly and silently where you are. There's no reason to wait if you think those three things are true, that Jesus is the King, that he died for you, and that you want to follow him. But for most, for others, I imagine you'll just listen, and that you'll get a sense from doing that of what is involved in being a Christian and becoming a Christian. And I hope you'll see there's nothing magic about the words. There's no special things you have to say. It is just those A, B, and C. The chocolate stays where it is. There's no ritual. There's no giving up Lent, any of that involved. You could just say this to Jesus whenever you are ready to and have an honest and sincere conversation with the God who made you. So I'm going to pray a simple prayer based around those three. And if you wanted to, you could say it silently with me. Dear Lord, I admit that I deserve your anger and need your help. I believe in Jesus' death in my place. And I commit to follow Jesus with my whole life. Amen. And let me finish just with one verse that we've talked about a few times during this week. It's on page 10. And the last verse in Mark chapter 3 on page 10. Jesus' offer to anybody who had prayed that and meant that is that from that point on, Jesus says, whoever does the will of God, by which he means believe and repent, he is my brother and sister and mother. And that is the offer of Jesus, and that is the promise of Jesus to anyone who will turn to him, as we've just described.